All right, we're talking to Steve Garrison from Force 10 here at Supercomputing. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Force 10 does? I mean, I'm not sure I had heard of them before, and I'm sure our listeners haven't either.
Okay, thanks, John. Sure. Force 10 makes an IP Ethernet switch routing device, which plays three key roles in an HPC or high-performance computing cluster, either as the interconnect fabric connecting the servers, transporting signals between those servers to build the computing fabric itself, or behind the communication fabric as a back-end device that's taking those signals and offloading it into the rest of the network environment, or actually in the LAN or WAN, transporting those signals either over regional distances or geographic distances, like in the TerraGrid across the entire U.S., connecting national labs.
So people building a Beowulf cluster, for example, might use one of your switching products to connect all of their compute nodes together?
Well, in a Beowulf cluster, actually, we'd be behind that. So that would be an example of the second scenario where we actually sit behind the cluster itself and help that cluster communicate with the rest of the LAN or WAN environment.
Okay. How big of stuff do you make?
That's our hallmark. We make big stuff. So one of the differentiators of Force 10 is that we were the first device to actually pass the terabit switch router benchmark. We support over 672 ports today in a single chassis, moving to 1,260 ports in a single chassis today. That's 2 to 3 times anybody else in the marketplace. And the reason that matters to this community, which is really the right question from my standpoint, it's not just a benchmark of a feature, is that every port yields a new CPU or a server connection, which means the computer gets faster. So a port equates to more computing power. More computing power means the researcher gets to do better and faster research.
How old is Force 10? It's a relatively new name to us, so.
Yeah, it's a great question. We are a new brand, but no, not to the HPC community. Some of the researchers throughout the government and research labs here in the U.S. helped Force 10 actually get started and helped us move towards this hallmark of high density and large equipment. We're 5 years old this year. We just raised our last round of funding before we go public. Hopefully next year we're very close to being profitable. We've got 275 people worldwide. We've got offices throughout the world, Korea, Japan, China, North America, and Western Europe. And we've got fantastic customers within the community, from NASA to the TerraGrid, the NCSA TerraGrid, Sandia, National Labs, Lawrence Livermore, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, Argonne Labs, University of Indiana. I can go on forever, but we've got about 20-some customers in the HPC marketplace.
And is it just the HPC market? But I mean,
well, no, it's that's one of our strongest verticals, if you will, where density of this type makes a difference. Again, each port means a computing port for the end user. We're also deployed in companies like Google, ESPN, where, again, large equipment building a high-speed and reliable network is a strategic competitive differentiator for Google or ESPN. ESPN's actually the SportsCenter HDTV production facilities built on our gear. So anytime you watch SportsCenter on an HDTV, that's Force 10 helping you get a crystal clear picture. Every time you do a search with Google every day, that's Force 10 helping to make sure that is a fast computing machine. We also work with carriers in Asia building up broadband networks. One thing that might be interesting to the listeners is that when we think of broadband here in the U.S., we're thinking of 1 megabit. If you're really in good position, you've got maybe 8 to 10 megabits. And in Asia, you can get a 100 megabit link to your house for $30 a month. So the networks in Asia are extremely large, extremely big in the sense of how much data they pass through their network. So again, that's another place our devices work very well.
I mean, I've heard, for example, that like South Korea, for example, is just like the population is so dense.
Correct.
that you don't nearly have this last mile problem like you do here in the States.
That's exactly right, John. In fact, the way people live in Korea, there's really only two or three dense cities where most of the population lives, and they have apartment buildings that might be 100 stories tall and 80 to 1,000 apartments per building. So bringing fiber to that building, A, there's no union or logistics issues, and B, once you do bring fiber to that building, the ROI or the ability to now connect thousands of people within that building are much more cost-effective. That's one reason. The second reason is the Korean government 5 years ago set out a government initiative to basically ensure that every Korean has a megabit. They've now stepped that up to make it now 5 megabits. and they're seeing non-tangible or tangible benefits from high-speed computing being available to the masses. That was a vision they had. Now that they have high-speed access to many of the residents of Korea, you're seeing things like tutorials at night for students, so you can learn over the web. The shopping is more prevalent than here. Gaming, we all have gaming in our minds here, Doom and things like that, but there are actually gaming parlors, and the gaming mentality of Korea is much different. In fact, if you had seen in the news lately, the gaming event here in the U.S., a Korean, Southern Korean gentleman actually won the gaming event. So there's thousands and thousands of young kids in Korea that go to gaming parlors and just game all night long because broadband access is so prevalent.
Yeah, I think there was a Wired story about this a few months ago that it's just that it's just huge there.
Huge. It's a huge phenomenon. Whether it comes to the U.S. or not, I think there's a couple of challenges. One, we like to play games in our houses here as opposed to go to a social environment. But again, the lack of broadband throughout the U.S. is still a bottleneck in getting that to happen. So it might be a trend that comes to the U.S. It may not. But if you ever get a chance to go to Southern Korea, go to a gaming parlor. It's a really interesting cultural experience, which I've done.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. You mentioned that terabit benchmark. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. There's a lot of people who throw out numbers about switching and routing devices. And to boil it up for the audience, I'm sure we've got people throughout the community here at CMU listening to this. When you look at a switching and routing platform, there are things you want to talk about, like density, how many ports per chassis, the speed or how many packets per second can it process, and then the reliability of the platform. And the speed is really one that people latch onto because it sort of equates to how efficient is the box in processing information, sort of like how efficient is an energy system or a dynamic system on the energy side, how quickly can you produce oil, or things like that. But processing packets, the benchmark there is basically a billion packets per second is a benchmark where people see that as an achievement. We're the first to do that. The Cisco CRS, as an example, was the state-of-the-art router announced earlier this year. Only does 960 million packets per second in a full rack. We do a billion packets per second in a half rack, so we think we've got twice the speed and half the size, so we like to say things like that. On the terabit side, when you get more than 500 ports in a chassis, when you look at duplex, meaning in and out, transmitting both in two directions, that leads to a terabit of processing power. So we've also achieved that because we're the first company to do over 500 ports in a given system. We're the first to achieve terabit scale. So those are two benchmarks and granular, irrefutable metrics that a scientist would look at and say, "Yep, that's right. 5 + 5 = 10. It's one answer."
Those are gig ports?
Gig ports. We also do 10 gigabit Ethernet, but right now the market's more interested in gigabit Ethernet density.
Right, right.
We do the same kinds of things with 10 gigabit Ethernet as far as density and terabit speeds, though, so it's just the form factor. Do you want 10 1 gigabit ports or one 10 gigabit Ethernet port? The math works out the same. We still do a billion packets per second. We still have terabits of capacity in the platform.
Where do you see a gigabit to the desktop going? I mean, what's the adoption of that like?
Oh, boy, that's a great question, John. I think there's three directions the industry can go. My personal belief is that wireless is becoming so prevalent, I think gig to the desktop won't really happen outside of special engineering teams or video production teams where that kind of connectivity is important. I think the mass market, what we're seeing, not only because of the cost of wireless, price points are dropping, the cost of cabling and upgrading that cable or maintaining that cable is very, very expensive. It's much cheaper to give people an access point on their desktop and install hotspots throughout the enterprise. They can move, you can move employees with no cost, people can move their laptops with no cost. It's becoming the model that I see. So personally, Steve Garrison from Force 10, not necessarily speaking for Force 10 on this issue, I think gig to the desktop is an interesting topic, but not a reality, outside of, again, a very niche engineering community that wants that kind of physical connection to a large SGI or Sun machine, for example.
Right. I mean, it hasn't been clear what the killer app would be for your average end user it's sitting in an office.
That's right. And in general, IT industry has proven time and time again that there never is a killer app. It's a combination of killer apps. It's a combination of bandwidth utilization due to larger applications. It's a combination of people needing more storage access and network-attached storage doing updates or mirroring to other local sites and needing that bandwidth to move that data around at high speed. It's moving voice to the desktop. It's moving multimedia applications to the desktop. It's all those things. And again, certain enterprises have more of those pain points today some enterprises don't have those pain points and may not have those pain points for years. So again, gig to the desktop is an interesting topic, but I think reality is that there'll be less and less gig to the desktop, there'll be more and more wireless to the desktop. In the wiring closet, though, where all these access points get aggregated, that's where dense gig and dense 10 gig and copper technology are going to be probably more prevalent over time.
So where do you think when do you think we're going to hit the ceiling on copper?
Never. Copper is cheap, it's installed, it's lower cost, and in general, the only reason people use fiber is for distance issues. And there's quite a bit of installed fiber or copper that's in the ground, over half. If you look at different metrics from IDC or Yankee, Gartner, what have you, largely half the population of enterprise seats or end stations are still wired by copper technology. Again, for an IT department to remove that copper, replace it with fiber, it's very expensive. So one of the mantras in the industry today is use it till it breaks or use it till it no longer works, and then consider the upgrade or replacement, which could be, again, many options, fiber, copper again, or wireless. And so copper infrastructure in the data center and in the enterprise is not going anywhere. It doesn't decay. It doesn't rust. It's pretty much there till you want to take it out or someone cuts it through some malicious behavior or mistake. And so that's why there's so much push from the IEEE for copper standards in GigE, CX4, and 10 GigE or 10 G base T, which will be coming out around 2007. So we're big believers in copper technology at Force 10.
Oh, wow. I mean, I guess I had heard some mumbling about 10 gig over copper, but I didn't know that anyone could actually do it. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the real challenge there is distance. And building the signaling or compression schemes to enable that type of bandwidth, that mount bandwidth, to go over a copper wire and still have a functional distance that's useful to people. Basically, if you yield something around 100 meters or 500 meters in that range, that'll be useful for pretty much 90% of the install base. That's one of the challenges of the CX4 standard, which is available today. It only goes to 15 meters. And if you think about that, that's about 45 feet. And a typical rack is 8 feet. So you can do the math. You can only go a couple of racks before that cable is no longer useful. So for a real enterprise over large distances or in a large data center, that's not acceptable technology today. That's why it has a niche adoption. So again, the mass market's waiting for the 10G base T standard.
So that's four pairs?
Correct.
And it's higher than 5E, Cat 5E though, isn't it?
Right. There's a little bit of a debate about that. People with 5E will still be able to use it. The point is it won't necessarily yield the standard distance that the IEEE comes up with. So for example, 5E, you may only be able to go 50 meters instead of 100. 6E and 7E today are being touted as 10 gig compliant to 100 meters. Again, that's not a commitment from the IEEE. That's the belief today, and in the next year or so we'll flush that out and be a little bit clearer on that. But that's the goal, is to make 6E and 7E compatible with the technology.
What's actually the difference between these different ratings of cabling?
It's not only the way that the cables are built, the twisted pair phenomenon, the way they're actually constructed to avoid crosstalk and signal dispersion issues throughout the cable. It's also the shielding, the physical plastic that's used within the individual strands. 7E has actually been promoted by the European community, in particular Germany, who has very stringent laws on emissions. And so if you really want to go for the gusto, get 7E. You'll have the best cable. It is expensive. Most people in North America are basically deploying 6E today. And again, 7E is more of a European driver. But again, if you're in a government facility, you're worried about emissions issues, I'd recommend 7E.
Okay, cool.
Can you talk a bit about the technology that enables you to do a terabit in a half rack?
Thanks, sure. It's a combination of four things. There's four elements of a switch router platform. You've got the backplane, which is basically your I/O bus that connects all the components. The other three components are line cards, obviously, which the ports connect to devices. The switch fabric, which switches and routes packets between the line cards, and then your central control module, where the image, the OS is stored, and those are the central blades that are basically the brain of the platform, no different than a central CPU in a PC environment. One of the things that we did was we made sure that each blade has its own CPU and intelligence to prevent congestion on the line card itself. we build a backplane that scales to 5 terabits to prevent congestion on the backplane or the bus. We built a switch fabric that's truly non-blocking that prevents congestion there. And again, our route processor module or control module is built so that it has actually 3 independent CPUs for processing layer 2 traffic, IP traffic, and management traffic independently. So we've tried to prevent congestion in our own box. That was step one. The second thing is making sure that all those components work as a system to get you to that level of bandwidth capacity within the product. And we've designed our own ASIC technology in-house and built that. That's one of the hallmarks of usually companies in the switching routing space is they build their own ASICs for the core components to either differentiate themselves on speed or some other level of functionality. We've chosen to differentiate ourselves on speed and density and the reliability of that overall system. So hopefully that answers your question on that level without getting too detailed, too granular.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because I guess back in the late 70s, you know, the graphics industry got started, and basically, if you know, they look like silicon, basically, that they're just doing chips, and now networking has gone that way.
That's exactly right. There's really 3 phases to the networking industry. If you go back to the early 90s, Cisco broke the ground with a software-based router or switch device that had one central CPU, very much like a PC. Everything was done in software, one CPU managing everything. In the late 90s, a whole new group of companies came out where they basically put some of that functionality into ASIC technology to offload that functionality from the central CPU. That took us to about the gigabit Ethernet world of the late 90s, early 2000. Force 10 felt that to get to 10 gigabit Ethernet and 100 gigabit Ethernet and terabit speeds, you needed to do something yet again, which is why we built the 3 CPU model to ensure that it's a new jump in bandwidth, let's make a new jump in processing power. And again, we've basically broken out our functionality so that different traffic types get processed with individual CPUs. That's when we've removed that, again, congestion from our own box from being a bottleneck, which is, again, why networks slow down when they get overloaded. The box wasn't designed to handle that level of traffic, and we've avoided that with our architecture.
All right. Steve Garrison, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot, and thanks to the CMU audience for listening.
All right, thanks.